From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, an attorney for the ACLU delves into matters of national security and individual liberties and says the two were not in conflict. Then a play opening tonight at Next Act Theater examines similar issues, starting with a simple question.
Could a method actor beat the polygraph test? But then he went on to say, how do we lie to ourselves? And what are the consequences of that, personally, relationship-wise, or a country lying to itself?
And singer-songwriter Zoe Muth turns out new songs that would be at home in a record store years ago and finds plenty of fans for it.
A huge amount of our fans seem to have gray hair. Somehow, I don't know, there's something about maybe the older folk musicians of the 60s and stuff that maybe I have something in common with.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North, and thanks so much for tuning in today. Earlier this week, the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court upheld the U.S. government's program that allows it to collect all the telephone records it desires from American phone companies. The government says such measures are needed to detect the activities of known and suspected terrorists. But civil libertarians question the broad nature of the action. The balance between individual privacy and the government's responsibility to protect its citizens is at the forefront of discussion in the news and even in the arts. Later in the program, we'll learn about a play opening tonight in Milwaukee that taps into issues just like these. But first, we're joined on the phone by Alex Abdo, staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union National Security Project. Alex, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Bonnie.
Is national security less important than our right to privacy?
No, I don't think so, but I don't think the two are in conflict. I think our framers of the Constitution recognized that our rights give strength to the nation, and they allow for an adequate defense of the nation. Where we went wrong in the years after 9/11 was to buy into the false dichotomy between the two and to try to sacrifice liberty in service of national security. I think many people in the country have recognized the flaw in that approach in the years after 9/11, and we're starting to see a return to our constitutional principles and our American values.
Do you think there's a threshold, at least in your opinion, when national security does trump privacy, individual privacy?
I don't think there is. You know, the Constitution allows the government to intrude upon individuals' privacy when it has adequate cause. When the government suspects that you are a terrorist, it absolutely should be surveilling you. It should be listening to your phone calls and reading your emails to the extent a court allows it to discover what your plans are, whether there are plots to thwart. What the government shouldn't be doing, however, is engaging in indiscriminate surveillance of Americans that's not tied to particular investigations that the government is allowed to conduct. That type of dragnet surveillance is not only unnecessary, it's unconstitutional.
So is that a key argument that you have against the decision this week by the surveillance court regarding the phone records?
That is a key argument. The NSA for the past 7 years has been engaging in a form of dragnet surveillance that has never before been seen in our country, and to my knowledge anyway, has never before been instituted by a constitutional democracy. We really are in a new era where the NSA is trying to exploit the fact that so much of our lives today are digitized. Every time we engage in a financial transaction or send a message to a friend or call a hospital or a pastor or a shelter for victims of violence, we leave a digital trail. And the NSA, to the NSA and to other intelligence agencies, that digital trail is virtually irresistible. Which is why it's so important that we put in place strong protections between our sensitive information and the government. And the Constitution has given us a roadmap to what those protections entail. And they entail requiring the government to go to a court before it wants to spy on Americans and to justify its case. The Constitution doesn't allow the government to acquire everything in the first instance so that it has it in the future in case it one day becomes relevant.
So this decision by the court is a step backward, in your opinion?
It is a step backward. The secret court in Washington, D.C., known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, has for the last 7 years allowed the NSA to keep a record of every single phone call made by every American every day. That type of database, the court found, was necessary for the government to do the types of surveillance it wanted to do, and we profoundly disagree with that assessment. For the government to conduct legitimate surveillance and investigation of suspected terrorists, the government can use its enormous tools in a targeted fashion. There's simply no need, for example, for the NSA to have a record of this phone call right now, or the phone call I'll make in a few minutes, or the phone calls that you've made today. Those records are not relevant to anything the NSA is doing, and they shouldn't be stored for years in an NSA database somewhere deep within the recesses of the government.
People do bring up the argument, though, we often hear it, that if you're not up to anything wrong, like you and I are simply having a conversation, what difference does it make if the government knows about this?
That argument has been bandied about, for quite some time, for the past few years anyway, the argument that if you have nothing to hide, why do you fear government surveillance? And I think that argument really underappreciates the value of privacy in our society to a dignified life. I think, in the first instance, I don't know that I believe everyone who tells me that they have nothing to hide. It's true that we all engage in conduct that everyone else knows about in a general sense. Everyone knows that I take a shower every day, and I, there are certain things about my life that are very public. That doesn't mean that everyone would want to share detailed conversations about those intimate affairs. But even to the extent that people are comfortable sharing some information with the government to ensure security, it's worth remembering that the constitutional protections that we so enjoy today are not primarily meant to protect those in the majority. It turns out that in a democracy with majoritarian rule, the majorities enjoy the protection of being in the majority. And that, for example, when those who don't have a political constituency want to engage in dissenting free speech, when they want to criticize the government or express unpopular thoughts, that's when our constitutional principles are most tested. And I think a very similar principle applies in the context of our privacy. It may be true that those in the majority are generally comfortable with what their majoritarian government wants to extract from them when it comes to their private information. But there's an important line between the right to privacy of some and the right to privacy of all. And we have to guard that line jealously if we're to stay a country of laws and a country committed to the values that were embodied in the Constitution.
Well, what's your take, then, on the public reaction to the Edward Snowden case and what it revealed about all of this data collection that probably most of us didn't know about?
I think the public has shifted its opinion dramatically since the disclosures. Before those disclosures, people, I think, by and large, viewed the possibility that the government was engaging in this extraordinary surveillance as very far-fetched. And in fact, the government repeatedly said, for example, when we were challenging some of these programs before we knew exactly what they were, the government said it's all speculation to think that the government is engaging in this form of dragnet surveillance. And government officials repeatedly misled even Congress when they described these opinions in hearings in Congress. Now that the public knows, the public is reacting, and the public is angry, and rightfully so. There was a vote in the House of Representatives not too long ago where the House nearly defunded the NSA's program in which it collects our phone records. And that was an extraordinary testament to how quickly public opinion has shifted. I don't think that vote will be the last one, and I don't think the debate is anywhere near over. And already we're seeing more calls for reform.
Well, to the ACLU, is there any appreciable difference between the government collecting this data and, say, Google or Amazon or another corporation collecting it for marketing purposes?
There absolutely is a difference. Google can't throw you in jail. Google can't investigate you in the way that the government can investigate you. And at the end of the day, the Constitution imposes real limits on the government's authority to amass this information. It's one thing for private citizen to contract with Google to receive, in my view, a great email service in exchange for a modicum of privacy. That's a bargain that each individual is entitled to make on their own. But when we engage in that bargain, we don't agree to sign ourselves up for pervasive surveillance by the government. Now, I should say, I think people are now beginning to appreciate how significant an amount of information is being collected by private corporations every single day about us. And people are starting to question the terms of their consent to turn over this information through their use of some of these services. And that conversation should continue. I think it's a separate conversation, though, than the one about what we expect the NSA to be collecting on us without our consent and without any particular need for the information.
Well, in a perfect world, what do you and the ACLU believe the perfect balance to be between individual liberties and rights and the right to be protected by your government?
I may be old-fashioned, but I think the balance is the one that the Constitution struck some time ago, which is that when the government wants to target someone for an investigation, it is absolutely permitted to do so if it can demonstrate adequate cause. It should go to a court if it wants to spy on Americans, and it should justify its case. If there is an emergency that prevents it from going to a court, there are a number of exceptions that allow it to do so that account for those emergencies. But the Constitution has been dealing with these cases, cases in which the government has a need to surveil some of the most notorious criminals in our history. It's been dealing with these cases for hundreds of years, and it's up to the task today, and we should rely on it in the way that we have in the past.
Well, how do we get back to that then? It seems, I mean, you were just talking earlier that, you know, we seem to have moved way past that, and now it's time to rein things in.
It is time to rein things in, and I think there are a couple of ways to do it. The first is that we need all the information necessary to have this debate. We have some of the information now, thanks in large part to leaks by Edward Snowden, but the government continues to withhold information that's critical to the debate that the government now says it welcomes. So we need a release of that information to allow a fully informed debate. And we're not asking for the government to disclose sensitive sources or methods or to reveal all of its secrets. But we're asking for the government to reveal what it thinks the law allows so we can have a debate about whether the law needs to be changed or whether it strikes the appropriate balance. I think that's the first step. We're hoping also to put an end to at least one of these programs through a lawsuit that we filed a few days after the disclosures. And our lawsuit challenges the NSA's collection of our phone records on a daily basis. And we hope that that lawsuit is successful and will solve at least one of the problems without having to have a protracted debate, during which this program continues to collect our sensitive information. But those are some of the first few steps.
Well, of course, the ACLU is set up to do just that, to defend civil liberties. Do you think the American people in general are too complacent about liberty?
I don't think the American public is complacent. I think it has just been misinformed and deny the information it needs to make its own assessment of whether these programs are lawful and necessary. And now that the information is becoming public, people are reacting. But it's difficult to blame the American public for not trying to reform that which it doesn't know. And that's a failure on the part of our government. Transparency is a truly necessary part of a democracy. You can't have a functioning government, at least one that represents the people, unless the people know what its government is up to. And of course, there are appropriate bounds for secrecy. There are certain things the government should be allowed to keep secret. But as a general matter, it should not be allowed to keep secret what it thinks the law means, what it thinks the law allows it to do, and its broad constitutional defense of these programs. Those need to be public so that Congress can have a debate with the American public, so that the American public can have a debate amongst itself, and so that it can vote for or against legislators it agrees or disagrees with on the merits of these surveillance programs.
Well, Alex Abdo, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. I hope that we can call on you again as events unfold.
thanks so much for having me, and I hope so.
Alex Abdo is staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union National Security Project. He spoke to us from his office in Manhattan. Coming up next, a play opening tonight at Next Act Theater tackles issues of privacy, security, and whistleblowing. We'll talk with the director and a staff member of the Milwaukee chapter of the ACLU when Lake Effect returns after this short break. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we spoke with Alex Abdo, staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union National Security Project, about government surveillance, individual privacy, and where the Constitution stands on those issues. The local chapter of the ACLU is partnering with Next Act Theater. Their season opener is a play whose subject could be ripped from the headlines: whistleblowing, integrity, privacy, and the choices we make. Perfect Mendacity by Chicago-born playwright Jason Wells opens tonight. I spoke with Next Act's producing artistic director David Cesarini and the ACLU Milwaukee chapter's development director Kristen Hansen about the play and the partnership between the two organizations. Cesarini explains why he chose this work to open the season.
The play was just attractive for me. It fits Next Act's mission, putting issues on the table for great discussion. But the writing is taut. There are wonderfully long scenes that are in real time. The characters are interesting. The relationships are dynamic and mysterious. And the layers of the onion get peeled. It's very entertaining. It's got a great blend of humor and mystery and drama. So it fits Next Act's bill perfectly.
The basic premise of the play is that there's somebody that we're not sure is a whistleblower. He might be, he might not be.
Right.
And he's about to undergo a polygraph.
Yes. His corporation is forcing a bunch of people to take polygraphs. They want to get to the bottom of it. So he goes to a consultant for training to try to beat the polygraph. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you noticed, just last week, a polygraph consultant was given 8 months of in prison for his activity teaching people how to beat the test. And so it's quite – just in that alone, it's a fairly fortuitous choice.
I was going to say it's completely up to the minute in terms of political events.
Right.
And so the play takes that. And, of course, with everything that's been going on in the news between WikiLeaks a few years ago and all of that continuing to build onto it, as well as Snowden, the most recent things, and that's continuing the whole NSA connection as well as MI6 and all of that – it all kind of it's in the zeitgeist right now.
It certainly opens the door for discussion of all those things. Though in a nutshell description of the play, I've come to realize it's about a man struggling with an emerging conscience. Jason Wells, the author, when asked why did you write the play, first he was wondering, could a method actor beat the polygraph test?
So that's where he started.
Yeah. But then he went on to say, how do we lie to ourselves? And what are the consequences of that, personally, relationship-wise, or a country lying to itself?
Well, and that idea of a man coming to grips with an emerging conscience is exactly what I think most whistleblowers do.
Yeah, yeah.
That all of a sudden they can't lie to themselves anymore.
Right. And this happens to be within a corporation, not necessarily, but it is government-connected. Yeah, it's a great mix of issues and also humor and surprise.
So how does the ACLU connection come in?
Last year, we were approached by Brian Farisee, who his tiny little Phantom Cicada theater group was having some difficulties out in Delafield with censorship. And, you know, we kind of looked at it, and was there real censorship going on, or was it just public pressure? That all worked out okay for them. And we wanted to give an award to Brian for standing in there and putting up with a lot of abuse, death threats. I mean, it was really terrible. And he said, you know who really should have that Civil Libertarian of the Year award is David Cesarini and Next Act Theater for saving us. Because if they hadn't stepped in and given us a place to perform this play, it really would have been censored. So we called David and said, you know, we've gotten this suggestion from Brian, and what do you think? And he said, I would be honored. And so that's kind of how that relationship started. And as we were collecting information for the award, one of the things that a staffer at NextAct sent to us was a lengthy email that David had sent to the arts community at large when this was happening and said, we cannot let this happen. We cannot let a play that is a farce, a silly little farce, turn into something that is censored and projects death threats and all of this going on. And one of the things he said, which I'm going to embarrass you right now, read this, is he said, this is about art. It's about speaking truth to power, answering ignorance with light, and responding to fear with humor. And I think that even works for Perfect Mendacity, because a lot of these issues are things that people are kind of scared of. You know, some people are scared of the thought that the NSA is surveilling us, that license plate trackers are tracking us, that there's a data fusion center that is collecting all of this data and coordinating it. It's kind of scary, and it's kind of so far out there that it's hard to grasp. Mm-hmm. So a play like this lets you think about it in a different way, absorb it in a different way, and then have that public dialogue.
On the other hand, there are also people who are scared that this needs to be the status quo, that we need surveillance because, look, the past 10 years, we have not had another serious terrorist attack in the United States. And so this play also opens the door for them to come in, the people who are on that side of these issues, to come and discuss and share their opinions about just what all of this, what all these issues mean to us as a nation. But I find it, in getting back to the struggling for with an emerging conscience, a conscience about lots of things, about many inconvenient truths that we all are sort of aware of and yet try to ignore or get blocked out during our daily lives of struggling to survive. Are we really over the tipping point? Do I really need to drive an 8-cylinder vehicle that gets 15 miles to the gallon on the highway? But I have it, and it's great, and I feel safe. What's our food system really doing to us? It's a lot of issues that I think we know we need to address.
And one of the things this play does so well, I think, is that it doesn't draw specific conclusions for you.
Mm-hmm.
It allows all of those gray areas to be there and for you to make your own judgment.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that the ACLU is really trying to do with this, the subject of surveillance and privacy. And we wrote an op-ed for the NextAct newsletter that talks about this, is we truly are asking the question, where is the line between national security and individual privacy? We don't know the answer. We're not trying to say we know and it's a secret and get us to tell you. We really want to have that discussion. And this is one way that we can have that discussion. You know, it's one thing to say we save money on policing by having license plate readers to catch speeders. So you don't need a human being sitting there, but you can have a license plate reader and you go through a stop sign or your speed or whatever and you get a ticket in the mail. That's nice. There are 3.2 million license plate images kept by the Milwaukee Police Department every single year. There are only 600,000 people in the city. So there's a giant database of license plate images sitting there. Might it be used for law enforcement? Maybe. What else is it sitting there for? And if you're a private citizen and you're not doing anything wrong, why is your license plate image from wherever you parked or wherever you drove sitting in a database someplace?
Mm-hmm.
These are questions that I think in a free society we need to ask.
And again, going back to the play and how this dovetails so well with, you know, raising those issues is that there are always gray areas.
Yep.
Yes.
You know, there's never a full right or a full wrong until there is a full right. You know,
which,
it's like until somebody hits a point.
Which is why we're really hoping that people come to this play and, like I said, you know, absorb these ideas in a comfortable and accessible way and then have that discussion. Come to the community panel on October 6th and we're going to have some educational information in the lobby that people can read during intermission and really have a debate and a good discussion about things. and think about it a little bit. Give yourself the room intellectually to think about it a little bit.
Well, David, you're also in the play. You're playing one of the fellows in it, not one of
yes.
the main characters. But for you as an actor in this, what are some of the challenges?
Well, the challenges of an actor being in the play is I'm also directing the play.
Right.
So, which was sort of a last minute decision on my part. I was very attracted to it as a director, and that decision was made. But then I also found that the part of Roger Stanhope was just sort of intriguing as this peripheral character, but yet very pivotal in the way things fall out. So I figured, okay, I think we can handle this. It's just he's in a small part of one scene, and then he's sitting outside of another scene for a lot of it. So and I have great people to work with and a great stage manager, and so we were able to direct ourselves and figure it out and go on with it. And technically, it's not an overly taxing show with sound and light cues and that sort of thing. So that shouldn't be.
So sitting in tech
problem.
For you is not going to be too hard.
Not too bad. No, yeah. No. So, yeah. And we even have an intern coming in who's going to sit on the sound console. So
lovely.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So you hope that this creates a bigger dialogue in the city? Is that what you hope? You want people to be thinking about things like surveillance and whistleblowing in a different way?
Absolutely. Or thinking about it, period. The driving force behind what we choose to put on stage at Next Act is that very desire to just simply get issues on the table and have discussion. And it doesn't have to be at Next Act. People go home, people go out to dinner, and there's something to talk about and something to consider so that the next time the issue comes up in the news, there's been forethought, there's been consideration on at least our patrons' part.
And what we're trying to do for our members, we started doing a couple of years ago and we'll be doing more of this, is to not only create events like we do Gallery Night now every spring and talk about civil liberties through visual art, but to find some of these performances where we can say to our members and our donors, here's a play that you should go see that allows us to think about some of these civil liberties issues. So we're doing an event on September 29th. A Sunday afternoon brunch, and then the performance of Perfect Mendacity, where we'll reach out to some of our donors and members, and we'll all get together and watch the play, and hopefully have a really good discussion about things afterwards.
It's a nice mix. Art and civil liberties actually coming together and talking
exactly.
about it and having a dialogue.
It's indeed. Such a natural, because art is, of course, about expression and these kinds of issues. So, for instance, for Gallery Night in the spring, our topic is going to be privacy. And you can imagine that's such a broad topic that artists will be able to bring us pieces. You know, what does privacy mean to you?
And that comes up in this play, too.
It absolutely
privacy
does.
Is one of the things.
Especially
that, yeah.
today when you've got Facebook and Twitter and all of this social media where somehow people put their whole lives out there, but there must still be some feeling that some things are private, and what are those things and how can we use art to talk about that the way that we're going to talk about it through theater at the end of the month.
And historically, artists in say, behind the Iron Curtain have for years held up a struggle. Certainly in the theater, there was always a subversive play in Czechoslovakia, I think, before the Iron Curtain came down, Poland as well. So dissidents have certainly centered or been channeled through the arts, that's for sure.
It should be entertaining as well as thought-provoking, but it will be a lively night in the theater.
Absolutely.
No matter what.
Okay. And not painful at all.
No, I've read the play twice, and I'm telling you, it's really good.
I want to thank you both so much for stopping by, and best of luck with it.
Thank
You're
you.
You're very welcome.
David Cesarini is the producing artistic director of Next Act Theater and the director of its season opener Perfect Mendacity, which opens tonight and runs through mid-October. Kristen Hansen is the development director of the Milwaukee chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU is partnering with Next Act Theater for this production. There's a link to all of the activities and how to get tickets at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Up next, Lake Effect essayist George Burdes considers the lost art of listening. That's when Lake Effect returns right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. We're often asked how many people hear Lake Effect every day. Well, it seems like it would be a synonym for the number of listeners that we have. But as Lake Effect essayist George Burdes points out, hearing and listening are not necessarily the same thing.
Gave away my ears the other day. It was to a friend. No, he had two of his own, so it wasn't like a transplant. Anyway, while I was doing that, I also pretty much zipped shut my mouth. Mostly, I just sat there and listened to him. I do that periodically. It's called being a friend, bending an honest, generous ear to a friend in need almost defines friendship. This pal of mine needed to talk, to lift a few heavy thoughts off his mind, but more importantly, he also needed to be heard. Those problems gnawing at him were rooted in his heart. Doesn't too much matter what they were. This I do know, they were important to him. In a sense, they were a kind of story, his story, and he needed to have it validated, to know that it was valued and important because it was being heard. You see, he wasn't asking for advice. He just needed to ease those problems by rubbing the balm of another human being's attention on them. Being chosen for that chore is probably one of the highest compliments anyone can bestow on a friend. In effect, it says that that person trusts you, values your silent attention and respectful confidence. Those of you who've had the experience as either the giver or receiver know the reward. Thing is, there aren't many good ear lenders around. It takes a certain quality to be a good listener. The point is that although we all hear, too few of us truly listen. Hearing is an act of the body. Listening is an act of the soul. We have all these high-tech, newfangled hearing aids, but they just don't make listening aids. Being a good listener is a true gift, one that we share just by lending an ear to a friend. But in lending that gift to a friend, you also give a gift to yourself. There's this other thing about listening that I've come to understand. It's embodied in an old story out of the Depression era, not unlike the job shortage situation we're facing today. As the story goes, a room is filled with applicants for a job as a telegraph operator. A steady, humming flow of dots and dashes filled the room, but it was competing with an even heavier drone of conversation. At one point, the door opened, and in walked another applicant for the job. He stood there a minute, walked over to the door marked office, and knocked. A man opened it and said to everyone, "Okay, you can all leave. We have our applicant." Well, understandably, all the others were furious and demanded an explanation. The man gave it to them with one word, "Listen." When the room fell silent, what they finally heard in those dots and dashes repeated over and over was this message: "If you hear this, knock on the door. The job is yours." I think that's what being a good listener is all about, rising above the din of noise and listening close with mind and heart. One thing for sure, that will always get you the rewarding job of helping a good friend in need.
Essayist George Burdes spends part of the year in Milwaukee and the warmer months in the North Woods. Many of his essays originally ran in a weekly series on WXPR and Rhinelander and now appear at his blog, East of Eagle River. We'll take one last break and then continue our in-studio concerts with a performance by Zoe Muth and the Lost High Rollers. So stick around for more Lake Effect right after this. Back with more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. We're getting a chance to listen to some musicians this week, all recorded in and around the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Zoe Muth emerged from the same surroundings that produced Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Soundgarden. But those weren't the sounds she gravitated toward. Muth and her band, The Lost High Rollers, generate a sound that would be at home on a scratchy vinyl record you might uncover in a Texas antique shop. Her voice elicits comparisons to some of the most loved country and Americana singers. Zoe Muth and The Lost High Rollers stopped by the Lake Effect Performance Studio to chat with Mitch Tyke, but they started with a song from their Starlight Hotel album called I've Been Gone.
Zoe Muth and the Lost High Rollers playing in Performance Studio C1, I've Been Gone. Thank you so much.
Sure.
There was a review of your music a few years ago, a glowing review, I think, that said something like, if you grew up listening to your country music on vinyl, this band is going to be for you. Do you see anything you do as especially old-fashioned or vinyl in its approach?
Well, I think all my main influences were from vinyl records or, you know, my dad's record collection. But I probably should be into new music more than I am. And I don't really aspire to be necessarily like any of that old music, but those were a lot of my main influences and, you know, old folk music and old classic rock. So,
well, and there is an irony because, I mean, the stuff you're putting out is new music. It just happens to have something in common with people that have come before.
Yeah, and a huge amount of our fans seem to have gray hair. Somehow, I don't know, there's something about maybe the older folk musicians of the 60s and stuff that maybe I have something in common with it.
Without necessarily having the gray hair.
Yeah. I think I have a couple, but my hair's blonde, so they're harder to see.
Well, and so if I have this right, you grew up in Seattle in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an important period for music in Seattle, but it's not music that sounded like this. So how did that music come to find you, or how did you come to find the music that influenced you growing up in that time at that place?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I wasn't musically rebellious enough. I just ended up listening to all my parents' records. And
such as?
Well, you know, a lot of like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, Richard Thompson, John Prine were always – Bruce Springsteen, you know, a lot of kind of rocky, folky singer-songwriter people. And
they don't seem like that. Those aren't artists you have to rebel against.
Yeah. It's hard to not like them, but, well, for me. And so I think from that, I always kind of had a tendency to like or want to discover what the roots of some of that music was, you know, the old country and blues. And when I was in high school, they had re-released a lot of the Alan Lomax folk recording stuff and just all the stories and like how these, you know, ethnomusicologists or whatever were going out into the field and trying to discover this other music that had never been commercially successful. Just all the stories seemed so cool, and hearing all these things that weren't really any part of my life growing up as a, you know, in the big city of Seattle. So it was just all seemed really magical, and all that old folk music and blues music kind of resonated somehow.
When you sat down to start writing songs, did it matter to you that you were not from that time or that place? I mean, could you feel like you could credibly channel that kind, that sound, that feel from Seattle?
It's always been something that I've thought about. You know, it's like people say, well, you sound like you're from West Virginia or something, even though you're from Seattle. And it's not really something that I've ever attempted to specifically try to sing like anybody or like sing with a Southern accent. I think maybe my grandpa's from West Virginia originally, so maybe something about some things in my genes. I don't know. So, I mean, I try to keep that in the back of my mind. It's like not trying to imitate something that's not me necessarily.
Do you – I mean, you say you didn't consciously try to sound a particular way like that. How did your singing voice come together? What was it that – I mean, you know, people don't generally go to school to become a folk singer or a country singer. So what were the formative experiences that led to who you are?
Well, I mean, the first music that I listened to when I was really young was like Cyndi Lauper and Madonna and, you know, the stuff that was on MTV, I guess, you know, the Bangles. And so when I was a little kid, you know, me and my sister would sit around and make tapes and make up songs. And I mean, they were all pretty cheesy. But I always loved singing and, you know, did the school choir in middle school and everything. But it really took a long time to feel confident in getting up on a stage in front of other people and singing. It wasn't – my family's not really that musical. They love listening to music, but nobody plays instruments or sings or anything. So, I mean, I remember singing a song when I was first trying to do open mics and getting interested in playing guitar and singing. I played for a friend of mine and I said, does that sound more in tune or out of tune? And he said, out of tune. So, I mean, it took a while to build up confidence and I just wanted to do it. And I've gotten better and better.
Well, it seems like that's a underrated part of the becoming a musician paradigm. Not just the being willing to stand up on a stage and perform, but to write stuff and have to get over both the hump that people will listen to you and people will hear what you've written and take it for what it is.
Playing music and singing and writing songs, I have had lots of jobs, and I went to college hoping to maybe be a social worker or a teacher. But I don't know, I feel like in the songs that I write and singing, it's the only way I can actually communicate with the world what's in my heart. So, I mean, it was just something that I've always felt like I had to do.
Well, we should hear another song, if you would care to do that for
sure.
Us. Tell us what we're going to hear.
This is a new one. It's going to be on a record that hopefully will come out early next year. It's called Mama Needs a Margarita. Thank you.
boy standing in line to take me out on the dancing floor. Two steppers and two timers, 7 cents and one liner. We tip our glasses back and call.
Great song. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is there a backstory to that?
I'm not a mom. But actually, there's a writer's workshop. Or I'm not exactly sure what you'd call it. It's called the Richard Hugo House in Seattle. And they commission writers and songwriters to write on a certain theme and then present it every month. And so the theme this time was motherhood. And they asked me to do it. And that was one of the songs that I came up with for that. And there's supposed to be a whole verse about watching the Rockford Files and Jimmy's eating tacos and, like, daydreaming about that. But I had to shorten it a little bit. But I don't know. It's just I was also a preschool teacher for a long time, almost 8 years. And so I just sort of tried to write from the perspective of – I never want to insult anyone, any, you know, motherhood with that song. Hopefully people just see the humor in it and not – oh, man, what a drag.
I think there are a lot of moms out there that could use a margarita.
Yeah.
maybe it's the influence of the instrumentation, but so much of what you do has this kind of melancholy tinge to it. Is it ever hard to reconcile being happy about the finished product with the melancholy sound that comes out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think all my favorite songs are pretty much sad songs. I mean, I think they help people heal or feel better, you know, even though it's the saddest story or whatever. And
are there ways that you know that what you're playing is being heard, that you're reaching people the way you want to reach them?
I mean, every time we play a show, I talk to people after the show, and it's great to hear that I have an experience that they, you know, they'll say, well, this song is the story of my life. I think a lot of what I write about is just like really everyday kind of stuff, you know, work and love gone wrong. Every once in a while, love gone right.
It is not really that different than what Bruce Springsteen was writing about all those years.
Yeah, I wish I could do it as well as him, but.
Are there things about you that you think people would find surprising for someone in this profession?
I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out what to do in this profession. Sometimes I think maybe I was meant to just stay in one spot and have a nice garden or something. Be a good cook or something, which I've never been able to be. But I mean, I love traveling and everything, but sometimes I say, oh, I don't really feel like talking to people tonight or whatever. And people say, man, you're in the wrong profession. You should be more exuberant and lively. And that's totally not me at all. But I still love, you know, once we get up on stage and we're playing, it's amazing. And
You made the move to Austin from Seattle earlier this year.
Yeah, in January.
There are a number of ways of asking it, but let me just ask, what have you gotten out of that move?
Actually, recently just went into the studio and played with a lot of great Austin musicians to make a new record. And that was, you know, really our goal. We'd been touring with the same band for about 2 years and just kind of needed a change. We thought, well, there's got to be at least one great guitar player in Austin, right? There's so many musicians there. It's hard to make your name or even make a living. I mean, I think bands that are really good at doing the Texas dance halls can do a lot better. I mean, we do play a lot of kind of country dance-ish music, but I also like to do a lot of long, slow story songs, and that hasn't necessarily worked, but we're working on it. We're playing the dive bar circuit of Austin.
Do you have any long, slow story songs you'd like to leave us with?
Sure, yeah. We could do New Mexico. New Mexico, down on Central Avenue, where the old highway it goes running through.
Zoe Muth and the Lost High Rollers spoke with Mitch Tyke in the Lake Effect Performance Studio after a concert this month at the Cafe Carp at Fort Atkinson. Our in-studio performance was engineered by John Strelecki, and you can see photos from the session at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have three very different musicians, each with Milwaukee ties and each playing in the area this weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
Well, I got a job waiting tables in the middle of